He's fairly new to UMass Lowell. He's Professor James Propp. And actually, I will introduce him in 2 seconds, but I'm just going to tease you by letting you know this isn't all going to be math, because I went on his website and he's got a lot of very interesting things to talk about. Professor Propp, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Sandra.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. And you are an interesting guy, judged by your website. I thought, oh, good, just in case the whole, I can't understand him on the math stuff. We got lots of other stuff to talk about. First of all, just tell us a little bit about yourself, when you joined us at UMass Lowell, and where you came from.
Well, I joined UMass Lowell about a year and a half ago, and I was previously at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And before that, I was at MIT, and before that, a bunch of other places. And I'm originally from New York.
Uh-huh. The city?
Not the city, no, from Long Island.
Uh-huh.
And tell me about your affinity for math. Did it start when you were very young? Did you always know that you loved the subject?
Yeah, I'm one of those who actually came to the subject before I even knew that it had a name. I just was fascinated by numbers from a very early age. So for me, there was never so much an issue of finding a calling. It was, should I answer the first call I ever got? And it was at some point clear that I should be a mathematician.
And it says on your website that your this is really how bad. The expertise is an area of math that I never even heard of. So, and yet when I was kind of rooting around on the internet last night, lots of people have heard about it because there's lots of pages about it, but I don't know what it is, and I'm not even sure I can pronounce it. It looks like it's combinatorics.
There's a funny story about that, because when my wife was dating me a decade ago, she was describing to one of her close friends what I did for a living, and she tripped over the word combinatorics, and he said, wait a second, this guy does it for a living and you can't pronounce it? But she can pronounce it now very extremely well.
So it is combinatorics.
Combinatorics.
What the heck is it?
Well, have you heard of permutations and combinations?
No. Well, adding.
Well, adding.
I've heard of adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing.
Okay, well, combinatorics is basically about the kind of math that starts with whole numbers and just works with addition and multiplication and subtraction, mostly avoiding division. It's things that you can count.
Oh, I love to avoid division.
Things you can count.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, how many ways can you dot, dot, dot?
Okay, give me an actual example.
Okay, here's one. Suppose you have three different hats and four different pairs of shoes.
Mm-hmm.
So a combinatorial question would be, leaving aside fashion issues, that some hats might not go with some pairs of shoes, how many wardrobes can you put together, different wardrobes on different days? How many different looks could you have with any all the different ways of combining any of three hats with any of four pairs of shoes?
Now, see, if I had gotten that kind of a mathematical problem as a schoolgirl, maybe I would have liked math better, because I can see the practical application for that.
Oh.
I'm just saying. So yeah. Not all math problems seem to me to have a problem. I mean, I'm sure that they do, but in my fevered brain. Anyway, so that's combinatorics.
Yeah, that's where it starts from.
Is that it reminds me, actually, of the kind of thing I would have done in high school algebra, where you got those kinds of problems where you had to come up with an equation to solve a problem like that. Is it algebraic?
Yeah, it becomes very algebraic. Addition and multiplication play a huge role.
And what are some of the more, that was a wonderful example you gave, thank you, because even I was able to understand it, but on the most sophisticated level, what sorts of problems today can that approach solve that would do you be involved with in research or study?
What sorts of problems on the frontiers? Well, there are some questions in physics which turn out to be approachable by combinatorial methods, where you try and count all the ways that something can happen. And so people try and understand properties of idealized versions of reality, little pieces of reality, by using combinatorics.
You're thinking of atomic actions and
yeah,
that sort of thing.
Yeah, thinking of the way crystals behave.
Ah, very small things.
So
most of the examples I've seen of combinatorics are usually at the very small level, that's right.
Mm-hmm. So that in a typical research, I don't know if there's such a thing as a typical research project, but in a research project then, I'm imagining that one would need people with a variety of skills. So you'd have, physics professors or physics researchers with one kind of knowledge, and then they might bring in someone like yourself, a mathematician, to help with some of the the calculations, some of the figuring.
It hasn't gone that way for me. I mean, I have had some interactions with people in mathematical physics, but by and large, they know enough math, so they don't have to bring me in for that. And it's not usually a question of people bringing in other people for a specific aspect of a project. It's not like subcontracting. Although sometimes people do get stuck on some part of a proof and call on someone with a specific expertise. Usually it's a bunch of people who have shared interests who say, let's try and find a way to solve this problem together. And it's not clear ahead of time who is going to make which contribution, but you're just trying to think together about a problem. But a lot of the time, it isn't collaborative. I mean, I prefer to collaborate, but quite often you just collaborate with yourself, and there you just hope that on different days you'll have different strengths so that over the course of time you'll be able to do more.
Are you also a person who's crazy about making up puzzles? Or
yes, I am. You got that from my site.
But it would lead naturally from asking a crazy question like, "What happens if?"
The thing, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit, because the one that tickled me the most was the one about the state capitals, because it involves words. You talked about
right.
You being attracted to math before you knew there was such a thing as math. I was attracted to words and writing before I could read or knew what words were. So the one that particularly tickled me was the list of names of places that you kind of worked with. I don't know what the word would be, but this is sound-alikes that would bring you to, that were a puzzle that you had to guess what the place was. Can you give us an example? I didn't write them down. Do you remember?
Oh, yes. Right. One of them had the clue, there are no atheists in foxholes.
Right. There are no atheists in foxholes.
And this
and
is supposed to lead me to
some capital city in the world.
Okay, so we can either do dead air while we think it, or you can give us the answer right away.
Or you could give us a hint.
Okay, that phrase is an adage that has to do with military actions.
Okay, so there are battle.
War is the right first part of the word.
Warsaw.
Yes, it's a Warsaw, that's right.
It's a Warsaw.
Oh, it's a Warsaw! Okay, excellent.
For those non-word people, a saw is an old
saying
that's, you know, trite or familiar.
Excellent. I'm very impressed that Sandra came up with that. I don't think I would have come up with it that quickly.
Thank you for giving me a Will Shorts moment.
One of the reasons, first of all, in case you're just joining us, we're talking with Professor James Propp. He teaches math here at UMass Lowell, originally scheduled you to talk about some mathematical concepts, and I do want to get to one or two more of those, but also, as is usually the case, you math guys are pretty interesting in some kind of like offbeat ways like we just talked about, which is a lot of fun. But the thing that I was curious about was infinity. Mm-hmm. Infinity, you know, it hurts my brain to think about for more than 2 seconds. Infinity is forever. Infinity is, you know, the biggest number you can think of plus one. Tell us from a mathematical point of view what infinity means and how it can be useful in I don't know, math thinking.
Life. How is it useful in life?
In life? I don't know if it's useful in life.
Okay.
Except maybe as a goal.
Yeah, that's
onward, ever onward. Sort of like, that's your motto. Well, that's infinity, sort of.
Is it used in math? Is it an actual mathematical concept that's useful?
It is. Sometimes it's more of an intuition or a mental picture than something you would call a respectable object of mathematics. But more and more it's become a respectable object in a bunch of different ways. I mean, one of the first infinities that got tamed was the idea of a vanishing point or a pointed infinity in geometry. If you draw two parallel lines on a plane, they never meet. But if you looked at a perspective drawing of two railroad tracks, they don't look parallel, and it looks like there's some point on the horizon where they meet. So a few centuries ago, mathematicians decided to create a kind of geometry in which there actually is a point at infinity where parallel lines meet.
Hmm.
And it's not the geometry of Euclid, but it certainly has applications to thinking about how the view of a you know an object in space changes as you move from place to place.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think that's the kind of infinity you're asking about.
Well, there's infinity, the word, the concept, which means you know forever or mm-hmm. never ending.
Mm-hmm.
And in math, when a mathematician talks about infinity, what does he or she mean?
Well, often they'll mean what one might call the size of a set that's so big that you could never run out of elements of that set, no matter how many you take out. So an example would be the set of prime numbers, mm-hmm. numbers like 2, 3, 5, 7, that you can't factor or break down as a product of smaller positive numbers, mm-hmm. whole numbers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the question is, well, do you want to try and think about them all at once? Well, then you've got what's called an actual infinity, and that can hurt your brain. But you could also just think of it as being a potential infinity, that anytime you want another prime, you can find one. Uh-huh. And so that's a place where infinity comes into mathematics a lot.
An open-endedness.
That's right.
But designated.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I talk to somebody who really likes math or, you know, took a lot of it in school or maybe even majored in it, one of the things that they say that they like about it is that there's a correct answer. That, mm-hmm. that you know, you get a problem and there's a correct answer. There may be more than one way to get there, as opposed to an English essay where, you know, explain the meaning of this book. That's, you know, to some people it seems a little too mushy. There's too many. There's no right answer. But when I think about something like infinity, I think, I don't know if there always is a right answer in math. Mm-hmm. How would you address that idea above always a right answer?
I guess I would say is that in mathematics, we sometimes find that an idea that seems like it's just one thing is actually a bunch of different concepts when we analyze it further, so that a notion like infinity is so bewildering that you can make up different mathematical theories for trying to think about it.
Hmm.
So there are some theories where infinity plus one is the same as infinity, and there are other kinds of theories where it's not. And it's not that there's a logical contradiction between them, it's just that you're playing two different games where you take this concept of infinity, which is beyond human comprehension, and you try and come up with some notion of what it might mean that we can actually think about and actually grasp with our finite minds. And there's more than one way to do that. So there can be more than one answer to a big question.
See, that's my theory, is that the way math is taught to so many young folks is that there is a right answer, there's a wrong answer, and it's very dry. But what I suspect is, more than suspect, really believe from people talking to people like yourself and other mathematicians I've talked to, that really the best of it is incredibly creative. And incredibly interesting and in ways that you kind of, maybe it's changed now, but that you don't really get in seventh grade.
Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely true.
It hasn't changed. You don't get it in seventh grade.
Oh, no, I was saying it's absolutely true that it's creative. My one-year-old son hasn't reached the age yet where I'm aware of how it's taught in schools nowadays. That's coming a decade from now. We'll see.
One of the other things that you mentioned that is an area of expertise is mathematical proof. What does that mean?
Is Did I say that I'm an expert in mathematics?
Actually, mathematical modeling. Is
okay.
that
no? That's no. I'm a pure mathematician, not an applied one. I admire applied math, but it's not something I do.
Okay, and that's what mathematical modeling is: applied math.
We could go back to mathematical proof.
All right, let's do that. All right, let's do that.
Okay.
What is it?
Mathematical proof is a structured argument which meets the requirements that a given era has set up for what is an airtight proof. And it's changed over time, so there are some proofs that a Greek mathematician of the ancient times would have accepted where we might point out a couple of flaws, but on the whole, it's fairly stable.
Hmm.
So once the community of mathematicians has certified something as true, usually it doesn't have to change its mind about it because the standards are fairly clear.
And what kinds of problems are these proofs meant to address?
Oh, all kinds of problems from all branches of mathematics. I mean, I could give one of my favorite examples,
yes.
unless someone has already given this example on the air in your show, the fact that there are infinitely many primes. Has anyone ever talked about that?
Not that I recall.
No.
Okay.
Go ahead. It's all yours. You own it.
Okay. So the question is, if you've got a bunch of primes and you're worried that there might be no more after that, like say you've got 2, 3, and 5, and you're wondering, well, maybe there are no more primes.
Mm-hmm.
One way you could convince yourself, theoretically, that there must be another prime after that is this trick of taking all the primes you know, multiplying them all together, and then adding 1. Because what you get when you multiply all these numbers together is some big number that's divisible by all those primes.
Yes. So you know that's not a prime.
That's right. But then right next to it, if you add 1, you get another number that can't be divisible by any of them.
Or by any other number.
Well, it might be divisible by some other number. Like, let's say the primes you know are 2 and 7, and you're worried there might not be any others. So you multiply them together, you get 14. You add 1 to that, you get 15. And I'm not saying 15 is prime.
Right.
But I'm saying that when you break it down into primes, all the primes that 15 is made of are different from all the primes you had before, the 2 and the 7. So I'm not saying this is a smart way to find primes, but I'm saying by pure thought, it's a way to convince yourself that there must
be. There are other primes.
Some other primes.
Uh-huh. Very clever.
Yeah.
So instead of just trial and error and saying, yes, but I can come up with one, you've got a method that always works, and that's a proof.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's the best way to find primes, but it's the best way to see that you're always going to find one if you look.
Yeah, okay.
It's interesting because that you had mentioned trial and error, Sandra, because, again, as I was kind of going around sort of math sites last night, I saw trial and error spoken about on some site, I can't remember, as though it were a legitimate and, you know, worthy way to solve a problem.
Works for me.
Which
yeah.
is, but see, that was the only method that worked for me when I was in school, and I was kind of led to believe it's because I wasn't that bright. So I just kind of like would throw myself at things until something worked. Under what circumstances is trial and error a good way to solve a problem, Jim?
It's a great way to solve a problem. If you don't know how to solve it, what else can you do but sort of throw yourself into it and make a mistake a few times until you get a feeling for what the problem's asking you to do. What you do afterwards usually is you clean up history so that when you're publishing a paper, you know, you don't talk about all the mistakes you made. You just talk about your successes, and you know it can often seem like you just had the idea and a flash of insight, but often it came from trying a lot of wrong ideas.
Excellent. We have a couple minutes left. I want to ask you about Pierre de Fermat. Is that
yep.
how you pronounce his name?
Mm-hmm.
He's a French mathematician of the 17th century. You have or are writing a book about him?
That's right. I'm in the midst of it. A few things happen on the way to my finishing it, but I do plan to finish it at some point.
Tell us about Pierre.
That one-year-old.
Tell us about Pierre and why you're writing about him.
Well, the story of Fermat's last theorem, this assertion he made in a sort of private journal of his, in the margin of a book, actually, has, you know, confounded mathematicians for centuries. It was finally proved about 10 years ago, and the story of how it fascinated people for a long time and elicited a lot of interest both from professional and amateur mathematicians, and then eventually got solved, is just a really interesting sort of case study of how knowledge advances. Mm-hmm. And he said, I've discovered this amazing proof of this result, but the margin of this book that I'm writing in my own private library, is too small to contain it.
And then he never wrote it anywhere else?
Never wrote it anywhere else.
And so somebody else finally proved it only 10 years ago?
That's right.
Wow, okay.
Actually, I guess at this point it was more like 14 years ago,
okay.
13 or 14, yeah.
So who proved Fermat's theorem, The Curious Incident of the Boasting Frenchman, is going to be your book?
That's correct.
All right. Well, when it's published, we're going to have you back on and talk about it in more detail because it sounds pretty interesting.
That'll be great.
All right. James Propp, a professor here at UMass Lowell, thanks for joining us and enlightening us a bit and being a good sport about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Good
you
talking
too.
To you.
We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, you'll have liner notes. Dave Perry taking a look at John Fogerty. You're listening to Sunrise on 91.5.